This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Reports of a memo outlining a plan by the Trump administration to narrow the definition of gender have sparked fear and resolve in the LGBTQ community. Over the weekend, members of Orlando's LGBTQ community gathered in front of City Hall to rally around the proclamation, "We won't be erased." Christopher Cuevas and Jordan Victoria Lau say they're reassured by the support they've received from city leaders, but they're nervous about what the federal government may do to roll back transgender rights. Well, Jordan Victoria Lau is a trans advocate in Orlando. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Also joined by Christopher Cuevas, Executive Director of Q Latin X. Christopher, welcome back to Intersection.
Thank you for having me.
So clearly there's some trepidation, I'm sure, amongst the LGBTQ community with the revelation of that memo. Walk us back a little bit and explain, if you could, Christopher, what it says and what the fears are.
Absolutely. So the Trump administration passed a memo along to the Department of Health and Human Services that would ask them to redefine gender based on the definition of sex, based on someone's external sex organs, and also to validify someone based on genetic testing. And so as our trans and gender nonconforming and intersex communities recognize, gender is not tied to sex. Those are two separate constructs. Gender is more of an internal sense of being and an external expression, whereas sex is linked more to biology. Mm-hmm. And so in effect, this memo and this ask to redefine gender by Health and Human Services would be the equivalent of erasing the experiences of transgender, gender nonconforming people, and would cause irreparable harm to those communities and to the intersex communities.
What are some of the kind of practical concerns you might have about a memo like this being put into action?
Mm-hmm. Well, presently, LGBTQ individuals across the country have no federal protections for discrimination in the Civil Rights Act. And so one of the big things is that a lot of the protections that were issued by the Obama era are being recalled by the Trump administration.
Such as?
Such as protections for trans youth in schools, being able to use restrooms of their choice, the issue from the Trump administration that would say that they wouldn't welcome transgender servicemen and women into the military. Things of those nature. Mm-hmm. And so the fact that they want to redefine gender could lead to discriminatory practices for individuals seeking social services, like those seeking safety in shelters, those that are incarcerated. Right now, we see that transgender individuals are at the highest rate of violence in our communities, often because they're misgendered, often because they're placed in facilities that don't align with their gender identity. And so the cause that this harm in redefining gender has tremendous ripple effects. Mm-hmm. And opens up our community to vast experiences of discrimination.
Jordan, just give me a sense of what is going through your mind now, thinking about this memo and what the implications might be.
The first thing is definitely fear. For all the years that we've put in this type of work and the community that we've done, as far as, you know, trying to define and share, you know, our experiences and our truths, just being told that, you know, doesn't mean anything. It also scares me to be that if I want to go shopping or if I need any medical advice or anything, to be turned away just because I align myself with being transgender. That's just unacceptable. I mean, this is America. Mm-hmm. And everybody should be treated the same. I have legal documentation that also says that I'm legally a female. That's for my safety. So I'm not harassed and I'm not questioned or anything like that. So for those rights to be taken away from me, it does bring a lot of fear to me and the community.
It seems to me that some of the advances that have been made, for example, marriage equality, that has kind of happened at the local and then the state level, right? And it's sort of spread upwards. So is the same kind of thing happening, or has that same thing been happening with the trans community as well?
Absolutely. I know Mayor Buddy Dyer has placed a lot of support for the community and a lot of rules and regulations to really help protect us locally. But it's not just about us. It's about everybody. And I like to make sure that we remember that it's not just us, it's everybody.
What would you say to people who aren't part of the trans community who are looking at this story and thinking, well, it's not me, so it doesn't affect me? Like, what's your kind of word of caution to them?
Well, it does affect you and affects everybody. And when you close your eyes to the actions of what our society gives to the most marginalized community of all communities, is pretty much enabling. And that's what I consider it. Not saying anything is enabling the issue.
What are some of the victories that the trans community has won over the last few years?
Well, I know lately I would say that we've been able to change our gender marker on our license, birth certificates for the most part. We're being spoken of. Mm-hmm. I won't necessarily say that there's been a lot that's been won. I wouldn't consider anything won. I just think that the rights that we've received are just something that should have been done anyway.
And now those are under threat?
Yes. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And to that, I mean, in Florida, we've seen, and across the nation, we've seen violence against transgender communities paramount. In Florida, we've seen 5 Black transgender women murdered. We've seen the National Coalition of Anti-Violence Projects has issued that 2017 was the deadliest year for transgender people. In this year alone, we've already seen 24 transgender individuals murdered across the country. And so the rollback of protections for transgender people can lead to violence. Mm-hmm. And so we need to continue to advocate for our communities. We need to push in federal legislation that enacts equality for transgender, gender nonconforming, and other LGBT identified individuals in our communities. There is an act called the Equality Act that has been proposed several times at the congressional level and hasn't succeeded. And so we're encouraging people to call their legislators to tell them that this is something that needs to move ahead, because it allows for LGBTQ individuals to feel protected under the Civil Rights Act.
And what's in that act? What would that do?
Well, it ensures that discrimination on the basis of the LGBTQ plus identity is protected, so that individuals of the trans experience, individuals of gender nonconforming experience, and individuals who identify as LGBTQ plus would have equal protections under the law.
What happens next with this memo then? What's your understanding of where it goes and what it signals as far as when there might be some change in the law?
Mm-hmm. Well, we have legal activists who are working with some of the national and state level partners to challenge this memo and to challenge the Trump administration, to be willing to challenge in courts if needed. And we have the members of the trans community who are pushing back against this erasure. A coalition of transgender Latinas did a banner drop during one of the World Series games.
Yes, they did.
Which was a really powerful statement, because mm-hmm. it says that we will not be erased during something that the president was even tweeting about in the midst of watching the game. So it shows that that there is action and that our community is pushing back against this erasure and this experience of violence that we're under threat of.
Jordan, you've also made some steps to try and bring some more attention to this issue and your cause here in Orlando, right? And there was a rally over the weekend. Just tell me about that and the kind of support that you have been finding in the community.
Well, I was really surprised. Obviously, I do, you know, I'm in the community a lot, so I get to see the amazing people that say they support us, but the fact that they actually showed up to really encourage us, to listen to us speak, it was just so powerful. It was just absolutely powerful. We set everything up in such a short period of time. And, you know, the biggest fear is always, is people going to be there? Is people going to show us that they care and that they encourage us? And they were there. It was a very, very powerful statement. I actually Googled to see if there's been any other trans rally in Orlando, and I have not been able to see one. So that one, to me, is you know, a part of history, especially here in the city of Orlando.
And we want to acknowledge the incredible speakers and the city for their support. Gina Duncan from Equality Florida, Nicole Parker from the One Pulse Foundation,
Patty Sheehan.
Patty Sheehan from the city, the mayor, in tweeting his support for the trans community, mm-hmm. among other speakers that were present. You know, the community really did make their voices heard and show strong visibility and solidarity. And that's important, especially during these really trying times.
If further steps are taken by the federal administration, you know, along the lines of this memo, are you going to be then relying more on the support of local communities to further your cause?
Absolutely. When the mayor tweeted out support, included in that message was showing that the human rights ordinances that were enacted in the city will ensure that transgender individuals within the city limits are protected. And we want to make sure that those are extended out to other cities across the Central Florida region. And so working with advocates in other cities to make sure that they're feeling secure, that they're feeling safe in their cities, and that we continue to push back at the state and federal level mm-hmm. for full equitable protections under the law. An example of that would be making sure that we reach out to our legislatures to encourage them to move forward with the Equality Act.
And what's happening at the state level?
So we have an LGBTQ caucus at the state level, and they're working actively to make sure that protections for LGBTQ individuals and the municipalities across the state mm-hmm. Are there and available and are being responsive to any of the urgent crises that arise.
Mm-hmm. Jordan, what do you say to folks who want to be helpful or want to be supportive and are not quite sure how they can help?
Well, first and foremost, always vote. Don't miss an election, even the midterms. Also, just always, you know, reach out. You know, we are very strong individuals in the community, but sometimes we are weak and it just takes somebody extending an arm out for us to feel comfortable. But just speak up, you know, and always support everybody in the community.
Are you seeing trans rights kind of specifically addressed by many candidates or even on the other side of the ledger, folks who are saying that they're campaigning on a platform that might align more with what's in this memo?
Well, that's what was really powerful about Saturday as well, is that we did have quite a few candidates that were present and very supportive listening to the speakers. So that was very encouraging. So as far as any, I know there's a lot of candidates out there right now that are running that, you know, showed their support. I'm at a point where, like, I'm not very political. Obviously, I know what I like, but I don't get into that aspect of it. Just vote. And vote for what's right.
Look at the policies, look at the candidates that are going to further equity for LGBTQ individuals and really for all communities that are experiencing marginalization.
So what's next, Christopher Cuevas?
So we're going to continue to rally the community. We're going to continue to encourage people to contact the White House, to contact their local legislature, to push for the Equality Act, and continue to make sure that this issue does not fall to the wayside and that it continues to get the visibility that it needs so that our communities can feel safe.
Jordan?
Just continue being visible, communicating. Sometimes fear is of the unknown. So always be visible, communicate, share your story, and just live your authentic life and be you.
Jordan Victoria Laos, trans advocate, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much again for having me.
And we're also joined by Christopher Cuevas, Executive Director of Q Latinx. Christopher, thank you as well.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Still to come, Orlando's popular cemetery keeper, Don Price, retires. But he promises he'll keep Greenwood's history alive with his monthly tours. We're back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Don Price was a teenager when he started working for the city of Orlando. Now, more than three decades later, he's stepping away from his role as the sexton of the city's Greenwood Cemetery. Price has made it his business to bring Orlando's history to life through his popular tours of the cemetery, pointing out the family plots that lend their name to city streets. Even in retirement, Price says he'll find a way to keep telling stories about Orlando's history. Well, Don Price, you're retiring from your role as the sexton of the Orlando Cemetery. How long have you been at the cemetery?
I've been at the cemetery since about 2003 is when I took on the job at the cemetery. But I started with the city in 1987. So I was 19 years old, fresh, started in the records department, worked my way up through the records department. And then right around 2003, they combined the cemetery with the records department because they wanted the cemetery to become a lively place. They wanted it to to have like stories told about it. They didn't want it a park. So with my background in the archives, they thought it'd be an ideal mix of the park. And it became fun. It became a passion at that point.
There are a couple of things happening around your retirement. One thing is there's a beer coming out that has your name on it, or at least the cemetery's name on it. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, it's a we partnered with 1010 Brewing this year. We had a oak tree that was about 150 years old and was struck by lightning. Now, when you think of lightning, think of it coming straight down and peeling the oak tree like a banana. It was that shape. So we took some of that oak, and this oak was almost petrified and so on by getting hit by the lightning. And we partnered with 1010, and they actually made a imperial stout out of a vanilla imperial stout, and they aged it through this cemetery oak. And it's a limited run, but it's actually an amazing tasting beer. But it's 11%. It's a high volume beer.
It's a weekend beer.
It's a weekend beer. But it's just a neat thing that they took a crazy idea and ran with it, you know. And you always hear, you know, some of the big beer companies, it's Beechwood aged or it's something aged. So ours is aged with cemetery oak. So this tree has lived. And so, you know, we kind of were joking around with the tagline that there's a little bit of history in every glass, because this tree has been at the cemetery and has soaked up that history. And now it's actually it's living again as a beer.
Drinkable history.
Drinkable history.
Normally at Halloween, you would be patrolling or at least keeping a watch on the place with your staff, because folks in the Orlando area have a habit of trying to bust into the cemetery. Maybe they drink a little too much. They think it's a fun idea. You've had to kind of fend off marauders Halloween's past, right? Are you going to be doing the same this year, or are you going to be out of the job by then?
Well, I personally won't be there, but staff will still be there. OPD will be. And, you know, luckily Halloween falls on a Wednesday. So we're hoping that some people have to go to work the next morning, and so there won't be the jumping when it comes on. The hardest time we have is when Halloween falls on a Friday or a Saturday, because that gives people all night. They leave a party at 2 in the morning, and where's the best place to come?
What's the craziest thing you've seen on a Halloween night?
Oh, one of my favorite stories one night is we were sitting up there waiting, and we heard the voices of about 4 or 5 people. And if you're trying to climb a fence at night in a cemetery and you've been drinking, you think you're quiet. But, you know, even the shh went through the cemetery. You could hear it all. So we let them get probably 50, 60 feet from us, and we lit them up with spotlights. They honestly stood there like a deer in a headlight. They stopped like, if they don't move, we don't see them. And as we started to approach them, one of them just started running back. When they got to the fence, I guess they forgot they climbed over the fence. She ran right through it. And she hit the fence, and it took down 30 feet of chain link fence just from her hitting it. And it was just one of those nights that you're going, you know. And then we had a set of ladies that were, you know, probably in their early 60s, climbed the gates one night because they just wanted to be scared at Halloween. And the funny part was, is where they climbed the gates, or we saw them, they could have went 10 feet over and the gate was 4 feet shorter, you know, the fence line. So, but it was kind of funny. So we get a lot of that where they just want to be scared on Halloween. So we usually scare them pretty good.
You have a podcast too, right? You just started that fairly recently.
Yeah, we're starting it. We've been recording them, and it will start really acting up in the next week or two. We'll start to really publish them. We wanted to have a few in the can, as they say. And it's just going to be short stories on Orlando's history. We would love to have as many people join in as possible, because that's how it's going to grow. It's you know, people are going to get tired of hearing my voice, but there's so many people that have so many stories and that just need to be out there. So that's what we're trying to do. And instead of your typical podcast where you spend an hour or so just talking back and forth, ours are going to kind of be more too straight and to the point. You know, take a particular building, talk about that history, talk about why it's still there, talk about, and hopefully, you know, people can learn and make Orlando, you know, a tighter community.
Are you worried about some of these buildings going away or some of these stories vanishing into the ether before you have time to get to them and capture them?
Of course. I mean, there's a lot going on. I mean, we were just talking about the other day at Lake Eola, you have the 1927 Luby House. Right next to that was one of the original Masonic lodges. And then, of course, at the corner of Central and Roslyn, you have that 7-Eleven. So you have a lot of history there at Lake Eola that is slated to be torn down. And they want to. There's going to be a 27-story high rise right there, and so you're taking a lot of that, and it's going to be gone.
Mm-hmm.
But in the same token, you can walk right around the corner, and you can see buildings that law firms are in or people are in that are actually restored buildings, and hopefully, with the closeness and that care, that they'll stay.
Do you see yourself as a bit of an advocate for preserving some of these places?
Of course, I'm more of an advocate for preserving our history.
Mm-hmm. But if you have a physical sign of that history, it's easier to get a handle on the story, right?
Right. But if some things have gone too far and it's not worth the money or worth the restoration, but you've got some buildings that are almost – I mean, just the other day we were walking by the right at the corner of Magnolia and Central is the Stagger Inn. It's a bar called the Stagger Inn. That was Dr. McEwen's original clinic. And Dr. McEwen was one of the three founders of what we now know as ORMC.
Mm-hmm.
So that was his clinic. So I had a photograph from 1911, and the building is almost unchanged. You can still see the windows are in the same place, the awnings. It's very been for all these years. But what's also unique is in that intersection was the original Johnny Reb. That's where it sat, right in that intersection by the library.
And then it moved to that other location near Lake Eola, and now it resides at the cemetery.
Right. And so a lot of people drive by the library every day, and they don't have that photo in their mind, that picture in their mind, that there actually was a 40-foot monument in the middle of the road.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the kind of stories we'd love to get out and kind of stories to do that. And then Heritage Square, which is 30 feet from there, you know, that's where Orlando started. And there's actually a compass point into the concrete that shows the original starting point of Orlando.
In your time as sexton of the cemetery has kind of become a bit of a repository for bits and pieces, artifacts from around the city. You know, you mentioned Johnny Reb. There's also the Sperry Fountain.
Mm-hmm.
You said that you wanted a swan boat.
I guess a swan boat.
That's probably not going to happen.
No, it's not going to happen.
No.
But I did get a cannon.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I got the cannon from Robert E. Lee Middle School.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's a great story in itself because there's a plaque on that cannon that says it was used in Gettysburg in 1863.
Which you found out isn't true.
Correct. The stamp that the cannon was made was 1864.
It's kind of funny finding these elements of fake news from the 1800s.
Yeah. And we actually have the originator of fake news buried at Greenwood, Walter Durante.
Mm-hmm.
And they teach journalism classes about him. He won a Pulitzer Prize in 1931 for a series of stories that he wrote for the New York Times about the Soviet Union. He won a Pulitzer Prize for these stories, never once mentioned Stalin and the millions of murderers and all this. Everything was beautiful in the Soviet Union, and he won a Pulitzer Prize.
Huh.
And he's buried at Greenwood.
Are you going to miss this job?
Yeah, I really am. I'm lucky enough to still be able to be a part of it, to do the tours and everything else. It's the day-to-day. A lot of people, when they see what I do and they see the side where I get to talk and I get to do the media and I get to do a lot of that, but what they don't see is dealing with the families where every day – you know, it's something new. I still have to deal with the deaths, and I have to deal with the suicides, and I have to deal with the car wrecks, and I have to deal with families that are at their worst and saddest part. And that's what wears you down.
Hmm.
It wears you down because, you know, they can teach you anything in school. You can learn anything you want in a book, but you will never learn how to sit across the table from someone that just lost a child and try to tell them it's okay.
What do you tell them then?
You don't. You listen. And because you can't tell someone that it'll be okay. You can't tell someone they're in a better place. There's things that you just cannot do. So that's what will wear you down in the job. mm-hmm. is the families. And they're all wonderful people. But you get them at a point that you end up living their sorrow for that day. And then as a cemetery, they visit a lot and your family's a lot. So you get to know them as your own family. And so you carry the burdens that they carry. And that's the part that I think that I won't miss as much. But I love the history, and I'll be there a lot just walking around, because now I have more time to walk around and come up with new stories and come up with new adventures on that.
You're a storyteller. I mean, you really relish the part of leading people through and telling the stories of Orlando. It must be, or it must have at least when you started doing this job, been, I imagine, a bit of a challenge for you to sit and listen and control that urge to tell stories.
Correct. And it is. But a lot of your stories and a lot of stories that I tell on tours and a lot of the stories I tell are actually from listening to the families, because they're the ones that can tell you a story. And then someone will come on the tour and they'll go, you know, let me tell you the story about my grandfather. You know, let me tell you this. And so the stories that I tell a lot are mostly from the stories that other people tell me. Mm-hmm. And I think it's easier to retain and easier to learn by stories, you know, just throwing out facts and throwing out figures. It's something that to me would be boring. So if I can link it into a story or link it into something that it might trigger your memory, that, you know, that's the trick to it. I've had people come up to me and go, you know, I went on your tour 2 years ago and I remember this, 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 and this. And it's because of the stories. They can place and trigger those thoughts just from the story.
Don Price, do you remember the first time you had to sit down with a bereaved family and walk them through the process?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. The first family I met with, it was a car accident. And it was they lost two children. So my very first one was dealing with a family that lost their entire family at one time. And that was one of my hardest days. And then it wasn't long after that, I went out to show this gentleman a gravesite. And we were talking. He was looking for four spaces. So I took him out, showed him the four spaces. Never got into a conversation about it or any of that. Come to find out, the day before, he had lost his wife and two children. So these four spaces before his family. And he looked at me and it was just, when he looked at me, he says, you know what? Yesterday I was a dad and a husband. Hmm. Today I'm burying my whole, you know, I'm getting ready to bury my entire family.
What was the story behind that?
Car accident again. It was a car accident. And so, you know, we've dealt over the years, of course, with suicides and the opioid addictions and then, you know, the murders, the, you know, old age. A lot of the people that I'm burying today are within 10 years of my own age. So it's becoming to the point that I said, you know, it's my time, 31 and a half years in, you know, I could enjoy. And, you know, we were laughing the other day and said, you know, I'd love to land at a place where, you know, I could serve a drink or two to somebody at a bar and be able to tell stories, sit there and talk like the old days. But, you know, it's something. I'm excited to see where I might land, but I'd like to do a bunch of little things instead of one big thing.
Mm-hmm. There is also Pulse, mm-hmm. and you played a fairly central role in helping some of those families grieve through that process.
Yeah, and we still are. We still get a lot of visitors to the Pulse area. Only because, you know, these were kids. They were young. They were dancing. They were just out for a night of entertainment. But being with their age, a lot of the friends and a lot of the acquaintances are the same age. They've never been through even a burial process. You know, a lot of them had never even lost a grandparent yet, or never lost any. So this was completely not only this tragedy, everything to them was new. And so even today, we have people that come out and have picnics still, and they have those graves are decorated with balloons and everything. It's just a different way to grieve. And this was an eye-opener for a lot of Orlando, these young kids.
Mm-hmm. Don Price, You have a plot at the cemetery?
Yes. Actually, I do. My family does. My mother lives on Lake Cherokee right downtown. She's been there probably 30 years plus. And so she has plots at Greenwood, and I'm going to slide right into hers. You know, I'll probably end up being cremated and go in right with the family plot right there.
There are some pretty grandiose kind of mausoleums, right, on cemetery property. Does the Price family have one of those?
No. The Price family just has a little stone on there. But, yeah, there's two more getting ready to come in. I mean, as Orlando starts to grow, you have people that want to be buried in the same style as they came from up north. And a lot of your burial practices up north, they are above ground, and they are. So we're starting to get a lot of those. We'll probably have another one installed next week, and we just had one 2 weeks ago.
Because that's also a tradition in, say, New Orleans, where they have to, right?
They have to.
There's reasons for building above ground.
And ours, you just have some people that just have a fear of going underground.
Mm.
And so the ones, as we say, that plan, they build them ahead of time. And the ones that don't really plan too well, we have to do a burial, and then 6 months later, once the mausoleum's built and everything's built, then they can move back in. But the one that's coming in a couple of weeks, both of them are still alive and well. They're just good planners.
Who do you think is going to be touring the cemetery, leading those tours, and telling your story 100 years from now?
I don't know. But I think that I'm going to leave on my epitaph, I'm going to leave something that is so bizarre that that folks will have to question, you know, if maybe like walked on the moon, skipped on. And so because people believe your epitaph. I mean, your epitaph, your last sentence on Earth.
And there are some funny ones in the cemetery, aren't there?
There's some great ones. Clem Ford, I guess I fell off the roof. You know, it's a wonderful epitaph. And then, of course, B.P. Roberts probably has the most famous in Key West. I told you I was sick. And so, yeah, I just did a tour for Orlando Lutheran Towers. And I ask everybody, when you go home, think of your epitaph. Think of if you had one sentence that described your entire life, what would it be? Because, you know, all we get out of life in a cemetery, you're born and you die. All you get is that dash. And that dash between your birth date and your death date describes your entire life. So I always say, you know, take that dash and just say one thing that can describe you. And so, you know, there's plenty of them out there. I think one of the quotes from the New Yorker article that was written a while back was an elegant redneck Southern gentleman. You know, that would keep people confused for months on that. So I don't know yet. I mean, I still got a lot of years to go to think about it, hopefully. And, you know, we'll see.
Don Price, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Still to come, an app that offers a new way to look at art. City Unseen brings augmented reality to the art world. Intersections back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. You've heard of Pokemon Go, the game where users could catch virtual monsters in the real world using their smartphone. The idea of using augmented reality has spilled over into the art world, and now Orlando residents can experience it for themselves at a new exhibit called City Unseen at Snap Orlando on Colonial Drive. Using an app, two-dimensional artworks appear to float off the wall. Viewers can walk through an artist's studio, and murals come alive. Patrick Kahn is the founder of Snap.
We have worked with international artists who are already AR savvy and who have already done installations in different places. So one of the artists whose installation we'll have in front of the Dr. Phillips on their lawn is a Miami artist who did the first AR installation at the PAM Museum in Miami during Art Basel last year. So this is really pretty prestigious. Another one, and I'm going to show you some of her installations. She's from LA, and she's currently probably one of the top AR artists in the news. Everybody's talking about her. And so she has a couple of installations. And then the third one is a San Francisco artist who is very, very prominent in the digital field. And we have done a projection mapping with him a month ago that I think you saw. And we are actually re-putting this projection mapping into the AR app so that people can see it again if they missed it.
Let's walk back a step, if we could, Patrick. What exactly is AR art? How is it incorporated into art?
So I think this is a relatively new concept. AR has been around for a long time. It has been used for many different industries. A lot of, let's say, designers and furniture places use AR in order to place furniture in a home so people can see, oh, I'd like to see the sofa like this in this place. Most of the public would know AR through two ways. One of them is Pokemon Go, and then the other one is Snapchat. With Snapchat, everybody is using the AR filters in order to have the bunny ears or all kinds of, you know, things that you can wear. But what is important to know is as your head moves, the augmented layer moves along with that. So that's what AR is. AR is that layer of digital medium that is incorporated into your reality. So how are we doing this with art? There's two ways we're going to do it. One is we're going to have art appear where there's nothing in front of you, and all of a sudden you can have a sculpture or piece of art appear right in front of you. And the other way we are incorporating it is, for instance, having a mural that does exist that people can enjoy, or a piece of art that people can see on a wall, but it has an augmented reality layer that you can see through your app.
So essentially, you got to download an app onto your phone to appreciate this.
Correct. So the app is called City Unseen. It's easily recognizable because we decided to actually make the logo our Snap logo, which is recognizable with the orange. So as soon as you see that Snap logo, you can download it. Now, our app is pretty heavy. You have to have Wi-Fi in order to download it, because above 150 megabytes, you have to have Wi-Fi, and ours is nearly 800 megabytes. So we recommend, and we're doing a lot of social media around this, that everybody pre-downloads the app before coming to our events, so that they don't have to have the hurdle of trying to download it when there's no Wi-Fi around.
How do you feel about having people need to use their phone to appreciate art? Does that kind of go against the grain of the essence of art, or is it okay?
Absolutely. That is, you know, we have two birds on our shoulder. One is the positive one, saying, this is so great, and the other one is saying, this is so dumb. And I've had this echo, and I'm working with it, because what I do know is that this is only year number one. This is a multi-year project. And we know that this is 1.0, that this is a time when it's kind of cumbersome, but a lot of the younger generation are already used to it. I think the older generation is going to kind of look at this and saying this is kind of gimmicky and cumbersome. But that being said, everything is going into augmented reality right now. This is going to be a new layer in our world altogether. So as an art organization, we want to be kind of upfront and start pushing this out, because in 2 or 3 years, you're not going to have the phones anymore. You're going to have glasses. The Oculus glasses are already under development. They're just too expensive for the public. So in 2 years, just like everybody has an iPhone, kind of like a computer in their hand that was never conceivable before, you'll have glasses where you walk around and everything will be augmented reality.
Are you looking forward to that future?
Well, I just want to be part of the flow. I want to make sure that I'm not behind. And, you know, I do see both sides, where it's a little bit kind of crazy in one way, that we are living in a mixed reality, that we have to have that virtual world part of our actual reality. But I also recognize that this is part of the evolution of where we're going. When you look at Facebook, you look at Apple and Google, everybody is putting a lot of efforts into developing the AR components, because that's the future.
I'm talking to Patrick Kahn at Snap Gallery in downtown Orlando, talking about City Unseen, which is an augmented reality art exhibit. I wonder if you could show me the app, Patrick.
Oh, absolutely. So I have a few things that I'm going to show you. The one thing that is really great is that we are distributing a postcard right now, which is the promo for our opening. Mm-hmm. That postcard is to be augmented as soon as you download the app. So on the back, it says download the app, and then you can see this postcard in augmented reality. Of course, it has all the information about the opening. So once you download the app, which I have in my phone, this is easy. And when it opens, right now we have a preview button that you just click, and it gives you a tiny explanation about the artist that you see here, and then you launch. Once you launch the AR, all you have to do is point to the card.
Oh, wow.
And the card comes alive.
So there's an image on the front of the card. Just for our listeners, describe what that image is before you overlay the augmented reality app over the top of it.
So, you know, it is a digital art by this artist from San Francisco who I talked about a little bit earlier. He is a very prominent digital artist, and he also works with AR. He does all kinds of mixed media artworks. So what he did the flat digital art that is on the wall right there, that is actually an exhibition piece. And the same goes when people will be here and they point to the art, they will have the same experience as onto the card. Mm-hmm.
But if they were looking at this image on the wall or on the postcard, it kind of looks like it's like a spiral or something.
I think of it almost like an abstract ballet dance, you know, with slow motion where you see all the movements of the ballet dancer. That's how I would describe it, but in a very abstract, non-figurative way. And so what happens with the augmented reality aspect is that it becomes not only dimensional in 3D, it floats above the card, but it is in full movement, so you see that whole motion.
And then what happens if you move your phone around or move the card around?
So you see it in all different directions.
Huh.
You can see it front, back, from above, from below. I'll show you some other ones as well, if you'd like.
Sure, let's take a look.
All right. So this is great because people can just take it home, and they already have a preview of the experience that they will see on a grander scale. Here is, I'm going to show you something really, you will probably describe it in better words than I do. But this is an artwork from an Australian artist. His name is Markomatic. So he is an illustrator, and we are going to bring his illustrations in 3D augmented reality. So here you go. Are you ready?
Yeah, let's do it. Oh, wow. It's interesting. It's almost like if you look at the picture on the wall, it's like a hovering image of a city.
It moves like a carousel, basically. It is a carousel.
It's like a carousel, and it's almost like a cardboard cutout or something, and then when you hold the app over it, it comes out of the wall. Can we take a look at the cat?
Yeah, the cat.
And this is, it looks like a parade float or something.
Look at the...
Yeah, the clouds are floating out from the wall.
Yeah. And then you have people coming up and down the stairs. You have a lot of details. He's very intricate in his work.
It's a little hard to describe again, but it's kind of like a steampunk cat.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah,
it's supersized. It's got people walking around on top of it.
I think
it's pretty incredible.
Pretty good description, Matt. So that's in the gallery experience. We have more, but what I would like to show you is to preview a couple of the experiences that you will have outside.
Sure.
Those are really grand. I'm going to give you a tour of one of the artists. She is an artist from L.A. It's Nancy Baker Kyle. And on our website, cityunseen.us, you'll have all the information about the artist and all the experiences. So here we go, right? So now we are totally in her studio. We are able to go very close, go to the end of the studio, go to her table, examine her tools. And as you go out, that's the most incredible thing. You have the door, and from the door, you're inside her studio. You see the real world. Do you remember when we had that wall where we did the inside out wall with for DACA? I don't know if you recall that, but it was building a community wall, and it was for DACA. Unfortunately, the wall had to be washed out because the owner of the wall said, okay, you know, after 6 weeks, they wanted the wall down. So we're bringing that same wall back in augmented reality. So people will go in front of that wall, and the whole wall will appear. But on top of that, we have recorded three of the DACA students who are going to give sound bites about their experience and their life.
My family and I left Colombia during the 90s in the narcotic wars. Right now, I'm a biology major and a global health minor at Rollins College. I'm also a health ambassador and part of a fellowship with the United Nations because I want to become an epidemiologist. I work hard, I study hard, I pay taxes. I volunteer for multiple organizations like Shepherd's Hope and Grace Medical Home. Well, I just want a normal life. I want to stop thinking that maybe today is the last day I'll see my parents because they're undocumented. It's not a life.
Each one has 30 seconds, mm-hmm. and just to give their message and just to for people to understand, you know, what this is all about. One thing also that I need to let people know is that this is not going to work on every device. That is a little bit of an issue with this new type of technology. Right now, it works with iPhone after iPhone 6S. So 6S and above. It won't work on a 5 or a 6 even. It will work on Pixel. It will work on Samsung with some of the newer devices. It does not work on LG. So there's a list of phones that it works on. It does not work on tablets yet. So this is all, this is kind of like a blue line almost for your number 2 and 3, where the technology is going to expand and it's going to become more widespread and more usable for everybody.
But so your goal would ideally be to have an app that's able to be used on any device.
Right. You know, this is something that is completely outside of our scope of knowledge, personally, and also control. For instance, having an app that works both on iOS and Android is already a nightmare for the developer. So that's what we've been working on for the past 6 months with the developers, is to make sure that it works on both platforms. Some of the apps that are developed by other people, they either work on iPhone or they either work on Android. And, you know, good luck if you have the other device. So we know that there's a lot of, hurdles, but we're looking at this being your number one. So also another thing is, as we develop, we're looking at this to expand in the geographical area of Orlando. Right now it's downtown, Mills 50, and we have just a couple of little locations outside of that. By year number 2, we'll add another 6. By year number 3, we'll add another 6 or 7. So we're hoping that by year number 3 in 2020, we may have about 20 different locations, making Orlando a real viable cultural destination all year long, instead of being a festival or being a blockbuster type of art exhibition or anything like that. This is all year long. So that's kind of the purpose of this.
Patrick Kahn is the curator at Snap Gallery. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're so welcome.
City Unseen launches this Friday at Snap Orlando on Colonial Drive and at sites across the city. Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our intern is Shania Richburg. Subscribe to the podcast on Google Play, iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And we're on the NPR One app. Here at 90.7, we rely on your contributions to fund local programs like Intersection that take a closer look at the issues in Central Florida. So if you appreciate that local programming, make a contribution during this fall silent drive. Call 1-800-785-2020 or go online to wmfe.org/support. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.